What's Underneath is a CastBox original produced in partnership with Studio 71.
CastBox is the fastest growing, highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android, where you can find all of your favorite podcasts.
You can listen to What's Underneath wherever you get your podcasts, but we hope you'll give CastBox a shot and see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to What's Underneath,
the podcast that will inspire radical self-acceptance through empowering you to embrace what's unrepeatable in you.
I'm Lily Mandelbaum, and sitting next to me is my mom, Elisa Goodkind.
And we are Style Like You. In our new podcast, we are going to expand the types of intimate, unfiltered conversations we've been having in our viral video series, The What's Underneath Project.
Each week, we will interview diverse nonconformists about their relationship to style, self-image, and identity.
Being radically honest without shame and holding that honesty with compassion is self-acceptance.
Mom?
Yes.
Who are we here with today?
We're here with my son and your brother, Louis. I spoke a lot about him in my interview, and I felt that it was sort of a natural extension in beginning this podcast to introduce him and our relationship with him before we go off, you know, past the family into interviewing other people, like our extended family. He was one of our first closet interviews. He's always been our guinea pigs. So I remember
any new project that we do, Louis is always one of the first people to be interviewed. And then years later, when the project is more well known, he's like, can I do it again?
And also right. Like when it's better. I mean, not right. That like this is bad, but I'm just saying, like, I know that like in 2 months, like you guys are going to be like rocking and rolling and it's like going to be this whole thing. And I'm going to be like, oh, cool.
And so I just want to say that I did, when we first started Style Like You at the very, very, very beginning, Louis, and you can still find the video, was our literally number one, well, maybe number two. Was it number two or number one?
I don't
one?
Know. It was just
Closet video that, and I did it with him.
What was the closet video, Mom, for those?
Closet video is when we started at the very beginning, we went into people's homes and they just talked about their style and what their style, why they love their style. And it was pretty basic and simple, but I still really treasure that video and look back on it a lot. He was one of our first What's Underneath guinea pigs.
For the What's Underneath Project video series.
So we're interested in this podcast series to go back to people, not necessarily everyone, but people that we have done these videos on in the past, just to see where they are now. And, you know, we find it interesting we're looking forward to following up and seeing the changes or, you know, what's happened. So for all those reasons, cool, we're doing this.
And Louis, how are you feeling right now?
I just got a little nervous, but I am excited because I like the opportunity to talk about myself.
Why?
I don't know. I think it's like cathartic and helps me like get perspective on my like life to talk about it in a broader way. As opposed to just like being in it all the time.
I think that's interesting based on the fact that you're pretty much an introvert.
What?
That you find speaking to people and connecting with people healthy and gives you a bigger perspective. And yet you're very introverted. You're very, you really value your alone time a lot, which is very the opposite from Lily and I.
Yeah. Well, I like, Lily was saying this the other night when we were like at a friend's house. Like I do like connecting and like being on and talking to people, but it's just in a finite, it just has to be finite. It's not that like I certainly would be like miserable and anxious and depressed if I like never spoke to anyone. That's not my desire.
Right.
So why did you get a little nervous?
I don't know. I always get jittery. I get performance anxiety.
Do you think that this is a performance?
No, but because I think I have a thing about needing to like be on. Like I think I still struggle sometimes with like myself being enough. So like I think sometimes I feel like I have to like turn something on, which I can turn on really easily, and usually like is the catalyst for it turning on is anxiety.
Do you with DJing, do you get performance anxiety?
I don't get performance anxiety really anymore with that. I mean, I guess like in certain situations, like if I was in a very new setting where I wasn't sure what I was going to be doing exactly. I might get a little bit, but I generally find that actually more exciting. Like when I do have those opportunities these days, because they're kind of few and far between. My anxiety with DJing is more about like the interactions I will have to have like on the way to the DJ booth. The interactions I'll have to have with like the staff at a venue, like what might I pick up about how they're feeling about me?
So judgment?
Judgment and like an existential anxiety that like people think I'm weird. So I sort of like have, or they find like that I'm so quirky that like, you know, I sometimes like want to get through the interact, like when I'm interacting with people that I don't feel like inherently like understand and appreciate that, or maybe are like thrown by it. That gives me anxiety because I don't want to like make them uncomfortable /I just want to like kind of get out of those interactions like as fast as possible generally.
I find that sort of fascinating because I have the complete opposite reaction to that. Like I like when people think that I'm quirky and I wouldn't want them to think any other way. But that's sort of interesting to me that you seem to feel like you want to make them comfortable or take care of them.
I guess that's not totally true. I mean, I definitely enjoy as an idea my quirkiness and I love it more and more. And when I feel I'm in the presence of other people that are appreciating it, like that's great. It's like my favorite feeling. But when it's out and I feel like it's being misunderstood, that's like really uncomfortable for me. And like brings up a lot of like my deeper wounds, like related to like being misunderstood, not like myself being dangerous to me somehow.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of, I mean, I guess I don't like to be blanket about this because I think like queer people experience and react to this in different ways. But I think when you grow up feeling like you have to sort of like that your safety is somewhat reliant on like how you're perceived by other people, and not making yourself too big so as to avoid, or at least that was my experience. Like, you know, like the sort of like how much of myself can I be around XYZ person without like putting myself in some sort of like danger.
Can you like give us a little bit like more details on some of the experiences that like when this started and what were some of the experiences that you were having that brought this to the surface?
I can't remember when it started, but it definitely started really young. Like the first thing that springs to my mind is like summer camp, and I went to like an all-boys summer camp, and that in and of itself I remember being like a very anxiety producing thing because I always from a young age felt much safer around women. So like getting shipped off to like a boys only zone was like definitely anxiety producing. And then and that was like when I was 9 or 10. So and then I, you know, there was a lot of like sexual awakening that occurred at summer camp in that environment because I was around a lot of boys and a lot of older boys, and the camp was like super old school, like World War II status, like open showers. And like one of my like biggest like memory, like one of like, you know, those like epic like little memories that like shape you, that like you just, they seem small, but they like end up just being like these like monolithic things in your like formation of your personality, is like being in those showers when I was like 9 or 10 and like realizing that I was like attracted to the other people in the shower and like being fucking freaked the fuck out and like not knowing like how I was going to like shower for like the entire summer. Like how was I, like just basic things like that. And like when, I remember being very fixated on like, when was I going to shower? Like when would be the safest time for me to shower? Trying to like isolate times in the day and the schedule of the day that I knew like the least people were going to be there.
Was that because you were so terrified of your feelings?
No, I was literally terrified of like my physical bodily reaction to like being there,
like, and getting a boner.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and that's what I mean.
Yeah. And yeah, that being something that was gonna like get me in trouble. Wow. And Yeah. And, but then also simultaneously, like, being, like, very drawn to it and, like, wanting to, like, spy on everybody in the shower. But, like, I would love to have, like, I remember wanting to, like, spy from a hidden place. but then just having massive anxiety around that being taking a shower.
Why do you think you were so afraid of that reaction?
Can you explain the larger reason why you were afraid? Well, yeah, I mean, I think in those days, especially, like, you know, it was, I definitely had embedded in me from a young age, and it's not a thing where I'm like, oh, I remember the moment that, like, I became conscious of this, but it somehow was, like, on a low grade from a young age that, like, that wasn't cool, slash, like, you get made fun of, like, that, like, gay people get made fun of, gay people get, like, scorned and potentially, like, physically harmed. So I don't know how I picked that up, but I definitely did. And I mean, like, in those days, like, it was very normal for, like, boys to just call each other, like, everything, every diss was, you're gay, that's gay, you know, you know, it, you're like, I just remember, like, that was just what everybody always said to each other. So I had an awareness of what being gay was, I guess. I don't know. Somehow I had an awareness of what it was, and that it was something that got mocked and it was seen as inherently negative.
Wow.
When you explain this, it just reminds me of, like, how little you shared about these experiences to me and mom, and, like, considering how close we were, like, how it's only been in, like, recent years that a lot of these, like, experiences of your early shame and, like, bullying and stuff like that, like, have come to the surface. Like, why do you think that is?
I mean, even listening to you just explain this is like, oh my God, how could you, that you kept that to yourself?
Yeah. I mean, it hurts me too, because I mean, but I really never considered any other option. I was very afraid. I remember just being very afraid of being aware of the reality that I was gay, that being something that, like, created a lot of fear and anxiety, even though it felt inevitable that I was gonna have to face it at some point. I remember just, like, it was more than not wanting to tell you guys. I think it was more that I just wasn't ready to look at it myself, and thus I think I felt that if I cued you guys into what was going on, it would through our closeness and, like, through our family relationship, like, your awareness of it would potentially force me to have to confront it.
It would make it real.
Yeah, it would make it real. And I was definitely not ready for that to be real. And so I just felt like it was the easiest and safest bet for me to just sort of, like, keep it to myself. And that was just because I didn't really, and it wasn't even that thought out. I mean, I just, like, literally, like, my way of dealing with it was to, like, try to kind of just, like, put it out of my mind. Like, that was just, like, how I strategized to handle what was, like, something that I just didn't have the equipment to deal with at the time emotionally. Yeah. That was just the best that I could do.
I have so many questions. Okay, so first of all, it's so unbelievably heartbreaking, because I remember, from my point of view, because I remember how incredibly adorably irresistible you were at that age, like 9 years old, going for the first time on the bus to camp. And you were so, I remember what you were wearing. I remember where you were sitting on the bus. I remember your face, like, you were so strong, like you wanted to go, like you wanted to go early to camp, earlier than Lily. You went earlier.
I'm kind of surprised to hear
you went earlier than Lily.
I used to hate doing group activity. I mean, like, I remember, like, I have nightmare memories of going skiing with Dad, and, like, he would put me in ski school, and I was like, please do not fucking put me in ski school. Like, there's nothing worse to me than, like, getting grouped in with these other kids and, like, this weird teacher, and you're just, like, sending me off for the day. Like, are you kidding?
But, like, you wanted, we
could just, like, be together and, like, and, like, I don't have to go to ski school.
Yeah, you went to sleep to the sleepaway camp, which, by the way, Lewis went to the sleepaway camp that his dad went to, and Lily went to the one that I went to in Maine. And you went at a younger age than she did, because you really wanted to go. And it was really hard for me. And I just remember what you were wearing, and I remember, your face, like just determined, you know, to say goodbye to me, which was really always hard for the two of us.
Oh my God. That's more what I remember is like how incredibly anxious I was.
You had like this really stiff upper lip.
You know, the thing that was cool, the thing that literally allowed me to survive a lot of this stuff was that I had an incredibly active imagination and I just lived inside of that for like most of my life. I still do. Like I was able to like turn camp into like some sort of like fantasia of like, I loved the independence. I was definitely, once I got there and I got over the initial separation anxiety, I loved feeling like I was doing my own thing. I loved like feeling like I felt like even though we were in bunks, like with like four people in a counselor, I was like, I have my own place. Like I sort of felt like I was like, I could like decorate my like little area. And like, I had like a lot of like fantasies about like being like a adventurer. Sort of like,
oh yeah, but you used to do like that when Lewis you were younger.
Clark. Yeah,
well, when you were younger, you were always, or even still sort of at that age, but definitely younger, every day you were a character. Captain Hook was a big one for a while, and then you would dress Lily up as, and then you would try to dress Lily up as Captain Hook. You would like take the,
I know, we were talking the other day, like when we were reflecting on the pilot, I was like, she was so didn't give a fuck about like being a good supporting character in my fantasy life.
No.
Like, she just like was,
she just stood there.
She was, and also she just like did her own, like she just like was like, I'm doing my thing. Like,
yeah.
And I was just like, your thing's not working. Like you need to do it better. But she, and I would get so upset.
Yeah. Like the time that the two of you were singing, Lewis memorized every single song and word to the Sound of Music, and Lily was the sidekick, and she starts taking her clothes off in order to get attention because he's in the front of the video and like, you know, demanding all the attention. So she starts throwing her clothes off
and, like, and banging on the freaking piano.
But anyway, so going back, so you were always dressing up, and then, then there was a Phantom of the Opera was a big one. Well, anyway, everything was like a fantasy, talking about your fantasy
world. Yeah, and looking back, like that was just like, I survived a lot of shit by doing that. Like that was a genius technique I developed.
Well, and I was going to ask you about like your other experiences of kind of like where you may not have shared things that were going on in your like formative years. But what just came to mind when you said that is like how you would come home after school in like middle school pretty much every day and just like shut the door to your room. And we had no idea what you were doing, but you were like making plays and stuff, mm-hmm. I think. But like
I would do everything from like making like stage sets out of like your Hermes scarves to and then do full-on productions, and I would run through the productions like in order, like with intermissions, like I'd get into like a routine with it, and like it was like it almost had like an official quality to it. Or I'd pretend to be like Britney Spears, or I would like,
you take
like
a blanket, right?
I would do all kinds of stuff,
something like with a blanket,
scarves.
So what was going on like during that time that you were maybe not sharing to us, but was painful or.
So I don't know like when exactly in the timeline this happened, but at a certain point and at camp, I don't have memories of being actively bullied. In early high school, you had put me in like this private school where it was really small. There was like 14 kids in the grade or whatever. And
in middle school.
And it was like, very closely sort of like there was more teachers than students, so it was like there wasn't a ton of room for like, and everyone was kind of sheltered. I don't know, and the boys and girls were separated, so there wasn't like a lot of room for bullying. But I was definitely like still having tons of like crazy internal experiences. Like all my friends started like kissing girls, and I remember at one point one of my best friends like got a blowjob in front of me, and it like, I remember like it just created like,
what this, year was that?
Probably in seventh grade, and I like was just in the room watching, and wow. I was like very like, it was like this sort of like steady formation of this like person that sort of like observed life but didn't like necessarily like participate in it, because I didn't know where I like fit into that sort of thing. Like I didn't know where, like the idea of like doing anything sexual like with another guy, like, was literally not even on the table. Even though, like, I did have a few experiences in middle school with, like, with a friend where we, like, fooled around a little bit in, like, a very sort of, like, it was couched in, like, wrestling. At a certain point, like, in high school, I started getting, like, actively attacked by, like, a group of guys. And, you know, they were friends with all of, like, the girlfriends that I really quickly made. And so, it, like, you know, it just basically was, like, they just took over and they would sort of, like, post up in this kind of common area in the school. And just, I, like, my big, like, shocker, because I hadn't really experienced, like, that kind of overt bullying up to that point, was, like, coming to, like, you had taken me shopping for, like, new clothes for ninth grade or whatever, and one of which included, like, this, like, pair of sort of, like, tight-fitting diesel black jeans that I, like, really wanted to get, and I thought they looked great, and I don't, and I'm having trouble remembering exactly what happened. Basically, I passed this group of guys, and they all, like paused what they were doing, and then essentially, like, just started, like, screaming and making fun of me with, like, all of my girlfriends hanging out with them, they were sort of laughing along. Everyone was kind of just sort of, like, laughing about the jeans and, like, that I looked like a faggot. And
so how did that affect you? What did you do?
I froze and I got really hot in the face. And I, like, literally, like, I just froze. I just remember just really freezing and shrinking and just sort of, like, feeling, like, paralyzed. And then, and just trying to, like, look away or just wanting to, like, get out of it. And then I just kind of, like, I just remember kind of, like, a zombie, like, walking upstairs in the building and just sort of, like, finding an empty classroom and just sort of, like, sitting there, like, staring at a wall for, like, hours and, like, just sort of, like, not, it wasn't like I cried or anything. I just, like, didn't, I just felt so overwhelmed by, like, you know, it was a lot to handle because I felt so attacked and I was so already, my identity already felt so fraught for me. And I was already, like, had enough going on inside. And I just, like, didn't really want to tell anybody about it because I just didn't want to draw attention, more attention to it.
Why were you still not wanting to draw attention to it? I mean, this is like, you're talking now, like, 15, a few 14. Years later.
I mean, even more actively, I became more consciously, it was coming to a head, but I also was fighting extra hard to have it not come to a head. So, yeah, I mean, I just felt like any talking about it to anybody was going to raise questions, especially, like, in your guys' mind. And I really didn't want to raise questions about it. I did not want you guys to have questions about it. That was a very, like, I was afraid that you would, and I had a ton of anxiety that you already thought it that I was gay. And I certainly, like, didn't think it would be, like, an advantageous strategy to tell you that lots of other people thought so too and were, like, making it a point to let me know that they thought so.
It kills me because I literally would have beaten the fucking shit out of those people.
Yeah, it wasn't about it.
I wish I could do it now.
It wasn't like, it's hard for me to process because it's not like I spent all of my psychic energy just keeping a lid on it. Like, I don't know. I got into a groove with doing that. Like, it was just the approach I started taking instinctually at a young age. And then I just really couldn't break out of it. I didn't have the self-awareness to stop it. I just sort of, like, kept getting going and getting more intense.
One of my most vivid memories of like, when I look back on it all and being like, whoa, like, this was, like, you really were, like, calculating a strategy for, like, hiding this. Like, I remember when we would be on, like, family vacations in, like, eighth grade or so, or ninth grade. I don't know what you were. Maybe you were in ninth grade by then. I don't remember. And you wrote a list of people that you had hooked up with, girls. And it came later, you told me that that list was completely like fabricated.
Yeah.
And you had me feeling so insecure because I had never kissed a boy and I was totally like...
Insecurity begets insecurity.
Yeah, I was totally like feeling ashamed
it's
that
a chain. It's like when you lie and then somebody else lies. I don't know. It could just become...
Was that like around that same time?
I mean, did you have anyone else that you felt...
To confide in?
Yeah, that you felt was gay also and or you had a best friend...
Not until I got to...
You had a best boyfriend.
Yeah, not until I got to 11th grade and switched schools.
That and did you switch schools because of the bullying?
Yes. I wanted to get the main impetus. I mean, I really hated Westchester and like definitely like had a fan. There was a part of like my... The fantasy that ended up developing around that time was that my life was a TV show. And I pretended for about like 6 or 7 years, like through early college, that like... My life was a TV show. Every single grade was like a different season in the TV show. And like it arose from like being obsessed with Sex and the City and like thinking like, wow, like that seems like a fun, cool way to like encapsulate your life. Like as like everything's a storyline, like everything's a, like the mundane is fantastical. I don't know. Like that was a big thing. So I would like walk around school all day and just sort of be like, this is a TV show. Everything that's happening around me is like just other characters in the TV show. And, you know, and because I think a lot of that arose from like, you know, I was fixated and fascinated on you. And I thought you were like so cool. And I thought of you as like a city person. And I was like,
he's talking about Elisa.
Oh, my mom. Yeah. And I just like thought you were just like so cool. And like, And so like that was part of it. And like your life prior to like moving to Westchester was like very like cool seeming to me. And then Sex and the City was like, I just wanted that. I wanted my life to be that.
Can you talk about how you feel like that strategizing how to like hide and avoid has like carried on into your adult life?
There's like plenty of things that like, especially like during my 20s that I now that I kind of knew at the time and I realized in retrospect, including my entire career, like it's just, I don't know, you can look at things through so many different lenses that it's hard to like have a definitive answer to like what's good and what's bad. I don't know. Like I on the one hand, like sort of see my entire DJing career as like this like sort of shadow protection mechanism I had against like being the artist that I really wanted to be. So there's like one lens through which I look at my DJing career is like, oh, this was like a very smartly strategized way for me to like have a creative and cool forward facing career that like ostensibly seemed like something where I was like utilizing an amazing talent that I had for music. But at the same time, like always sort of knowing in the back of my mind that like that wasn't really like what I wanted the be all and end all of my like artistic and creative and professional life to be, but sort of just hoping that it would sort of like suffice as like a cover. So there's one lens through which I look at it that way and I go like, Christ, you know, I wish I had started writing and acting and everything that I'm doing now earlier. But then on the other hand, I sort of think like, now I have a different perspective on it where I'm sort of like, you know, and I see that as, you know, an extension of the strategy that I developed, you know, as in middle school and high school, like do that. That's to me, I see that as like part of it.
Can I just before, I just want to make sure it's clear because we skipped over like what I feel like are two of the next big strategies you developed to like cover yourself from like being your full self,
right?
Like having a girlfriend and then being really obese like for a while.
Right.
I don't know. I don't want to go too much into it because it's like
it was in his What's Underneath.
Just because we don't need to if it's not naturally coming up. But I just think it would be good so that people do understand like what you're talking about when you talk about like covering up like
for
these
sure.
strategies. Like
yeah, well, towards the end of my tenure as a straight man, I got. The final piece when I was like felt like kind of the house of cards was like maybe potentially starting to fall down / when I was dealing with like, you know, everybody else around me like having sexual experiences and you know, me not knowing exactly where to turn with that and feeling a lot of pressure to have sex and to have this experience, I started dating somebody from a tennis teen tour the summer between my the summer between my
sophomore and junior year
and we dated For a year. I mean, it was convenient because she lived in San Francisco. So it was like, you know, we weren't together all the time, but it was kind of like, I sort of view that as like, that was like my like last ditch effort to prove to everyone / myself that it wasn't real, that I wasn't gay. And I was still, it wasn't like I was like, it wasn't this thing of being like inside, like, oh, I'm gay and I need to like create this cover. Like it wasn't like the CIA, but it was like, I was still trying to, I was still hoping to show myself that I wasn't, you know what I mean? Like it was still, you know, so, and it, you know, and we had sex and it was, you know, and I really, it wasn't like I, you know, I really, we were very close friends and I, you know, and it was her, you know, I lost my virginity. She lost her virginity. You know, it was still, there was like intimacy that was real. But it was also, I think that relationship was really the final catalyst, especially as it wore on, where I was like, this is untenable.
I remember the day that that happened. She was hysterical.
Well, I broke up
with her. And Lily and I were sitting outside the room of your door. Your door was shut and we were listening to the conversation.
I know. And Lily was crying. I remember what was kind of happening was she... It was like just at that point I had switched to school in the city. I had this very, very close other closeted friend, guy friend. Finally, it was like the first time I had really like found another Sam. And, and you know, and he was like, he made me look like, you know, super hetero. I mean, he was very flamboyant and like my whole strategy was to kind of try to mask myself. Like he was still saying he was straight, but like acted like a total faggot. I mean, like he was just like, you know, it was like really out there in a kind of admirable way. I mean, he was really
super cute.
He always actually used to joke that like I, when I first got to school, cause he had been at the school for longer, like I like made a point to like show, to like kind of like angle my like D&G logo pants like towards him at a certain point to like sort of as like a sort of like coded language of like that we were kindred spirits. And anyway, so yeah, so then yeah, and then basically the girlfriend was gonna move here for that summer and live with us, and I was just like, fuck no, like this can't possibly happen. Like I was freaking out, and that ultimately was like, I think probably the catalyst where I was like, this can't, I have to, this is real.
If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please subscribe and give us a good rating so the powers that be can keep this podcast going.
Yeah, so that was like what, 2000?
I graduated from high school in 2005, so this was all going down in like
early 2000s,
you know, 2003.
And now it's 2018, so like 15 years ish later.
Yeah. I think things have both changed enormously, and there's still like so far to go. That I mean, I think there's no question that my experience going to high school in New York City and being of this family in 2018 would have been insanely different.
I think. Be like, you tell me who you are.
Yeah,
you
know? Well, that's just very new. Like, it just wasn't what was going down at that time. And I think like in school, I just think I would have been surrounded by other people that were like, I mean, it would have been so, so different. And I think, you know, it's not cool anymore to like be homophobic. And when I was a kid, like that was, it was totally cool. Like those kids that made fun of me were the cool kids. Like, I don't think that that's in our liberal little bubble.
In what way were they the cool kids? I was going to ask you that. Were they like athletes?
They were the ones that were like having parties and like fucking girls and, you know, doing like, just like whatever. They were like running. They were definitely like the clique that was cool. So in that way, I think things have changed enormously. And like, you know, a person I interacted with recently, her son, she was saying how her son came out of the closet when he was 11. And, you know, there's a part of me that's like, obviously like, wow, that's so amazing. But then I have a part of myself that like feels like a sort of like immense sadness around the fact that like,
it's still
that
11.
Kid's life is now going to be like he's going to get to like explore that like in a normal way, in like a much more explore his sexuality and explore being himself as a youth in a much more like normal, natural way. And that like, I'm still at 30, like trying to kind of like make up for missing a lot of that like natural development. That's like a little bit hard for me sometimes. And then in terms of like how far we have to go with it all, you know, I still am disgusted by the dearth of representation of gay, well, all LGBTQ people, obviously, but I'm just particularly tuned into the gay male aspect of it just because that's, you know, my experience. And, you know, I've had a number of powerful experiences over my, mostly my adult life of seeing real, few and far between real, honest, and out there representations of gayness that I connect to, that speaks directly to me. And I continue to be floored and grossed out by how unique and rare it still feels in 2018 for that to happen.
So in other words, if there's like the one movie in it or the one TV show and everyone's going, we've come so far.
Yeah. It's
what's like, your feeling about that?
Well, it's like, you know, I saw Call Me By Your Name this summer, you know, this winter, which I thought was just gorgeous and a very, exactly what I'm talking about in terms of like presenting these things in a way that just presenting like coming into your sexuality as a gay male and being in a gay relationship and exploring that and all of the, it was so nuanced and detailed and so real. And it like literally, because I'm so used to watching movies and hearing music and stuff where, you know, I think all queer people feel this way, where it's like, we're used to telegraphing our experiences onto this heteronormative media culture that we live in. So when it speaks to you so directly, it's almost like, not only is it moving because it's moving, but it's also moving because it's fucking so unique and almost, it almost feels weird. It almost feels like too much. That movie almost was like too much. I don't think I could ever watch it again because it was so, it just was such a powerful experience. And it happened to me the other day. There's this singer, Troye Sivan, who is he's 20 years old and was like a YouTube sensation who's like transitioned into singing. And he's like, definitely like he's going for like mainstream pop music, but he's like singing about like his new single is like explicitly about like the first time he like bottomed during gay sex, and like I'm just like, I'm so pleased that that's happening, you know what I mean? And like that it's also not a kind of music that's like I feel like fringy. There's been people that make gay music, but it's always been like, you know, left of center, underground, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there's something very powerful to me about seeing this kind of like, you know, middle of the road pop artist. I mean, he's not that he's middle of the road, but that he's going for, you know, mass popularity and he's like singing a song about bottoming, like is amazing, but also is just like, how is it 2018? And like, this is so unique.
Why do you think it's so, why is it, what is the problem?
I think people get very, even though, you know, like, and theoretically people accept these things more, I think the actual experience of it is still hard for people and still feels out of the norm. Like, I think no matter how accepting people are, I think you can't erase centuries of this stuff being under the rug. So I still think, like you're the average person, like, in Brooklyn, you know, I think there's a lot of people that, like, are very accepting and support gay marriage and, you know, are liberal and progressive people, but, like, do they know about gay sex? Do they know like the details of how it all works? Do they know the struggles that we're all facing related to how culture still deals with us? Like, do they know what I'm talking about right now? And is that something that they're actively thinking about? And when something feels out of the norm or out of what they're comfortable from experiencing in media and in music and in film, I still think people don't like necessarily gravitate towards being challenged in that way, including myself. That's what I'm starting to talk about in terms of Call Me By Your Name. It's like, it's still weird and shocking for me. So of course it's going to be for everyone. And like, I don't think that bridge has been fully crossed yet in terms of like in popular culture.
Does it bother you that the two actors are straight?
It does and it doesn't. Like, it's hard for me to be bothered because I think they both did such a beautiful job and it was so well done. And their performances were so clearly well researched and like lived in, and it not one minute of it rang false to me. But when I zoom out and I think about the fact that gay actors have been basically like shoved into the closet for all of Hollywood history and thus haven't been given the opportunity to flourish as actors as other people have, because they've been told for so many years to put who they really are into a closet and into a box, and you can't be a good actor when you do that, or you can't be an expansive actor that could play a role like that if you're not being upfront with yourself. You couldn't play that role. A gay actor that was like trying to shove themselves into the closet isn't going to be able to play a role that's like actively exploring these issues. So that upsets me, that when I think about the fact that, like, you know, now Hollywood is going to potentially start like making millions and millions of dollars off of telling these stories, when meanwhile they've oppressed us and created so much misery and ruined people's lives, you know, with these kind of standards. That does upset me for sure.
What is the biggest risk you've taken in your life?
The biggest risk I've taken in my life, I don't know if I could pinpoint one thing. I mean, if I was going to say like a tangible thing, it would obviously have been, making the pilot I made this winter.
Can you talk about it? Can we hear all about it?
Yeah. It's a really personal project and it's impossible for me to untangle, the journey of making it from making it as a piece of art and the journey of just making it from my personal journey through all of the stuff that I've been sharing so far.
So what's it about?
So it's about...
Can I just say, you actually, your life, what you imagined your life to be, a TV show.
Yeah.
And now you have made the TV show. Yeah. And you're in it.
Exactly.
And your sister's in it.
Exactly. But yeah, the pilot is like very, very, very closely based on my life. And it's about, you know, I mean, on you know, in a sort of like, you know, log line kind of way, it's about like a gay DJ sort of like navigating, you know, bros and hoes, bottle service, nightlife culture, which is what I've essentially been doing for the past 10 years.
What is that? Like, why is that an interesting thing? Why is that?
Well, you know, my journey with DJing has, you know, it can sort of like, I think, give some insight into like, you know, a lot of my evolution in terms of like how I've thought about my sexuality, because when I first got into it, you know, in my early 20s, I'd been out of the closet for a long time, but I had sort of developed, I think, a thing a lot of gay guys have as a knee-jerk reaction to coming out of the closet, which is, you know, I'm gay, but, you know, I'm not going to sort of like associate myself with like other gay guys and like gay culture. Like it's sort of like a continued internalized homophobia that like follows you out of the closet. And it's subconscious. You think you're out, so you're being yourself and you're da-da-da-da-da, but in reality, you're still really being run by shame.
Or you didn't want to define yourself or box yourself into like...
But, you know, yes, that for sure. I didn't want
to
box...
You used to say I didn't want to define myself by being gay. And I yeah, but like it's that's so... changed a lot.
Oh my God. I like only want to define... I mean, I don't only, but I like... I am so... Like, I love to define myself that way. There is literally zero part of myself that would ever want to join you guys.
Can we ask why?
I think I feel free from a lot of crap.
Like what?
Like, just the way that heteronormative culture has, like, forced men and women to be. The more snugly you fit into the patriarchy, the more of a victim you are of it.
So you were talking about, you were explaining the purpose of the show.
So as a DJ, I sort of like thrust myself into like DJing only in like these kind of like very, like it's ironic given that like I have seen those environments as such a source of suffering, but I like thrust myself into this culture that was so dominated by like hetero, like hyper-masculine men, you know, trying to impress, you know, dainty women teetering in heels by buying them alcohol. And, you know, and I was like, you know, I'm into hip hop. I'm going to play aggressive, you know, masculine music. And I'm just going to, you know, and I'm not going to be part of like the gay nightlife world. So I spent years, and unfortunately I'm still stuck in it, DJing like for my oppressors,
who do oppress you, right? They're pretty
Yeah, I mean, just because, like, not, they're not doing it on purpose. I have great empathy for them if I they're not in my face. But it's so funny, and that's just, like, completely reversed now to the point where, like, I would really love to be only DJing for other queer people. But show, basically, like, that's the sort of, like, you know, top line premise of it. But as it sort of developed over time, you know, it's really it's just a very personal piece about my struggle with shame related and hiding. Shame and hiding related to my, you know, to my latent struggles with my sexuality post coming out of the closet, and how that played out in terms of both, like, my isolating myself from having intimacy and relationships with other men, which I have struggled with a lot in my adult life, and how I have struggled with owning my path as an artist and putting myself out there as an artist and the show. And it speaks to what I was talking about earlier in the podcast about using DJing as sort of a shadow career / cover, another sort of cover, for those to sort of hide behind.
Right. So, but then it all gave you the food and the material to actually step out.
Right. Like, my character in the show is also, you know, is on the verge of his 30th birthday, and sort of like me in real life, aspiring to make the show. He aspires to be a songwriter and producer and superstar kind of, you know, musician, DJ, and he is just not able to get past himself and his sort of all of the shit that's been piled on top of him, you know, from all of this struggle that he's had with his sexuality. He's really stuck from it in his life.
And so you wrote the show, you independently produced it, and you acted in it, and you're now trying to pitch it to networks to become
a series.
Yeah. Can you talk about why it was the biggest risk you've ever taken?
If you had asked me, like, at any point in my life, if I could open a door and on the other side of the door was the life I wanted and I could just do it, and there wasn't anything standing between me and having the ultimate thing that I wanted, I would have, hands down, at pretty much every phase had said it would be writing and starring in my own TV show or work or movie. I don't know, like, something in that realm, like, out front, a star, writing things that people connect to, for sure. At the same time, I had literally really resigned myself to not doing that. I mean, I tried everything that I possibly could to find a way to not do that, because, you know, as someone who spent their whole life with hiding as a primary strategy, like, it's a pretty big leap to go from, like, yes, I want this thing, but also my main function in life is to avoid being criticized, avoid being seen, avoid being, you know, vulnerable to attack. So, like, those two things, you know, they're pretty oppositional forces. And, you know, in my head, I always, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, because it's like, in my head, I thought that the hiding impulse was the strongest, and that was running the show. This is the point that's made me realize, like, no, it's actually the life force that wants to heal and wants to expand to the fullest potential is way stronger, because even in spite of having that viewpoint and an entire adult life that I viewed as, like, where I just was like, what's, you know, is it going to be DJing? Is it going to be, you know, getting a job, you know, writing about music, you know, hiding behind my computer? Is it going to, not that that's inherently a thing, but just for me personally, is it going to be moving to a farm? Is it going to be, what is going to be the thing that I can do to not have to do this, that'll make me happy enough and fulfilled enough, that I can sort of trick myself into not doing this,
and not so, doing the most risky and the thing that you're meant
to, not
expanding,
and not putting myself
out there
in the way that is demanded for the thing I really wanted through the door. When, you know, the thing I want through the opening door, of course, you don't just get to walk through that door. You first have to cross a whole Rubicon of self-doubt, and you know, it doesn't work that way. But it is a good, I think, thing for everybody to constantly reflect on, because I think you can easily lose track of, like, what do you really want to be doing under the sort of, like, constant day-to-day psychological drama in your head, like you can lose sight of like, oh, like it's important to remember that like if you removed all that drama, what would you want? You know what I mean? If you didn't have the drama, because the truth is, if you really do want something, you can make it through all of the drama. You know, but you have to be clear on like that you want it. And I think you have to remind yourself, oh, right. Like, it's like, that is what I want. And that is attainable. But
the drama's resistance.
Right. And then, but I think then in terms of the risk, you know, it was just like, it's hard for me to understate the risk. And it really, I think the simplest way for me to say it is, and I think it's obvious at this point, is because it was like the moment in my life where I decided like I was going to stop hiding from wanting to do this, hiding from the person I could see myself becoming through doing this, hiding from making myself vulnerable and putting myself out there, hiding from rejection, hiding from being laughed at. I mean, I talk home mom every day, like during this process, like, you know, whether it was through pre-production, through the shoot, through the feedback rounds we've been getting, the focus groups we've been having, whatever, like, you know, it always comes back to me calling mom and going, I think everyone's laughing at me. I think everyone's making fun of me behind my back. I think everybody, like, that's like the fear that continues to come up, as I get further down this path. And like that, I think that, you know, what's great about it is now, like, that's a fear that I'm not being dominated by, cause I'm still moving forward. Whereas I think that was the number one operative prior was don't get laughed at, you know, don't.
It's so intensely poetic, the whole thing, like that you spent your whole life undercover, hiding, creating in your mind this idea that your life's a TV show and creating this fantasy world in order to cope with the harshness of not being able to be yourself. And now actually
the TV show is the thing.
The TV show is the thing that's liberating you.
1,000,000%.
And that you're like not finally really not hiding.
It's
not the sex.
Like you couldn't script the whole thing.
Yeah, but
like,
your TV show is the opposite of Sex and the City. I mean, it's so painstakingly real. It is the opposite of hiding. It is like your blood, guts, you are naked in it. And 100%. That, so in a way, like you're really coming out now.
That's exactly right. I mean, but I'm coming out now as opposed to when I was 16 in like an intentional way. And I have the tools to like navigate through it in a way that isn't just sort of like the world is happening to me. Like I'm happening to the world. So which is a much better place to be. And you know, like when you talk about the gaining weight thing, I think, you know, when I came out the first time, I was so much in a, oh my God, the world is happening to me thing that I just sort of like drowned physically. I drowned myself physically, but I like, you know, cause I gained like 100 pounds, like pretty much soon after coming out of the closet the first time. So, and I think, you know, it's like everything, like, you know, we always joke about my therapy, you know, like I'm obsessed with my therapist, but my therapist talked about this.
Shout out Wendy.
Shout out to Wendy. My therapist.
Wendy, do you have
a
duplicate? No.
My therapist always talked about how like this process of making this was like giving birth to myself. And I like I can't tell you how accurate of a depiction that is. Like everything I thought about myself, every limitation that I saw myself having coming into this, like I realized wasn't actually real. Like a person that was scared, a person that couldn't assert themselves, a person that like couldn't express what they needed, a person that was afraid to be judged, like, you know, all of those things proved themselves not to be so true.
Delusional.
Yeah. And like, not that I still don't struggle with it. And every day I do continue to face these fears, and I often get sidetracked and stuck. And, you know, it's not like I've like, you know, that's the other thing. It's not like growth is linear and you just cross the threshold and then everything's just like a fucking cakewalk, because it's not. But I definitely now have this new perspective on like, wow, I actually like don't. Like everything, like I, you know, before this, I was like, I thought I knew everything. I thought I knew everything about myself. I thought I knew everything about the world. I thought I, you know, da 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 da. And like that actually proves not to be true. Like you can really fucking surprise yourself. And you know, a lot of and the risk. And this is what I've been like coming to a lot lately is like risk, like believing in yourself and believing in the universe and trusting the universe is a choice that you make. Like it's not, I think there's a misperception that like something is going to happen to you that makes you do that. Like you're going to be validated by the outside. You're going to be told, you're good enough by somebody, or you're going to be accepted by somebody, and then you'll start to trust, and then you'll start to see it. It actually doesn't work that way. It works in reverse. You have to first take this giant leap. At least for me, it's a giant leap. As a as a person that like invests a lot in logic, it's very hard. It's been historically very hard for me to trust the universe, to trust other people, because I'm like, well, what's the proof? What's the result of this trust going to be? You know what I mean? Can you give me a concrete, you know, reason that I should believe in it? And you don't actually have that. You don't get that. You just have to actually do the trusting first. And then the universe like rises to meet you once you do that.
Surrender.
Yeah.
It's like and rises to
meet
surrender.
You, and rises to meet you in ways that like are beyond your wildest imagination. But first you have to like take this incredibly scary risk where you just jump into this black void. That's how it feels, where you do not have like a tangible thing that's like, this is why you should trust. Like there is that will never happen. You just have to do it.
And then also just taking all of the adversity, the really intense adversity that you faced and that one faces and that people face. And instead of resisting it and fighting with it, you surrender to that trust. And that's, you know, and then it sort of ushers you or guides you.
Well, you keep reconnecting to it, and, you know, cause like you wanna always return to the controlling part of yourself that thinks like your anxiety is helping you get a grip on everything, and that you're like not trusting is making you more in control. Like that's how you like you instinctually want to go back to that. And then when that gets too unbearable, you have to remind yourself like, I'm not in control at the end of the day. And there's forces outside of myself that are greater than me, that if I just sort of connect to that and realize that they're already working, and they're working all the time, and they're working when I'm lazy, and they're working when I'm uninspired, and they're working when I'm, you know, they're always working, even when they don't seem like they are. And growth is painful. Like I think in like our modern imagination about self-help, we think of growth as like this ecstatic eat, pray, love, you know, fiesta.
Just start meditating and you're just going to go right into growth.
But
and
growth,
happiness.
Yeah. 90, I mean, there's, oh, and there is that part of growth. There is those moments where, I mean, and like making this pilot was so one for me where it was just like, wow, like this is so cool. And I can feel myself growing and it feels great. And I feel amazing. And like,
supported
I feel
by all these people.
Yeah. I feel the best I've ever felt. And I feel like at peace with the universe and like I'm connected to the stars. And then 90% of growth feels horrible and like really uncomfortable and like and icky and like and weird and confusing and like terrible
and lost.
But that doesn't mean that it isn't growth. I think that that's like the thing that people that we lose track of is like that is growth. And like I think a lot of fucking unhappiness arises from false expectations. And I think setting the right expectation for how you're going to feel in a certain situation, which is that, yeah, you're growing and it's going to feel fucking terrible a lot of the time, is a really helpful way to like reorient your mind around it.
What's your biggest source of shame, remaining source of shame?
How do I pick just one? I think right now I'm dealing with the first thing that comes to mind is related to relationships and intimacy, romantic relationships and intimacy, because I've never been in a relationship with a guy, like an actual functioning, both of us in it, really relationship. And you know, that's been a thing that's evolved over time. Like I spend a lot of my 20s just sort of like doing the thing that I always have done in the past, which is like pushing it out of my awareness. My line through the majority of my 20s was like, I don't want to be in a relationship. Like, I don't even want this. It's not for me. I'm not doing this. And that was my way of sort of like, you know, I have a lot of wounds around intimacy. There's a lot of wounds that's a core danger zone with a lot of fear. And I like my way of confronting that through my 20s was to just go like, I don't want this. Like, it's just not something I'm looking for. And also that gave me, because I don't think I was prepared to experience actual intimacy. I wasn't comfortable with myself. I wasn't comfortable like exposing myself to most people, to myself, you know, even though I was out of the closet, to myself, I didn't really want to be seen, you know, aside from you guys, like I never really let anybody else see too much about me. I wanted to really control my image for all the reasons that we've discussed, and so that really precludes a true intimate romantic partnership. I'm still dealing with that anxiety and fear around that right now, except now I'm coming at it from a place of like awareness about how much I really desperately do want that.
And you're willing to be vulnerable.
Exactly. So but that doesn't mean that I'm still not like fucking freaked, like every minute of dating and trying to find a relationship, and every sexual experience and everything isn't like filled with all kinds of
shame,
body shame, tons of stuff. When I meet somebody new and I go on a date, or somehow like it comes up, like talk about your, you know, about our past relationship history. And I'm like, well, I don't have one, you know, like I still haven't totally like figured out how to like, you know, I always know, and I aspire to be, I know one thing I know as an idea, and I'm very confident in, is like when you own everything about yourself and you stand behind it 100%, and you realize, as I said, as I've talked about a lot, that you're on a journey, and your journey is your journey. And it's like, there's nothing about your journey makes you more broken than another person. It's just, that's your journey. And if you just stand behind that journey 100%, like that's what, you know, that's all you need to do. And people that, you know, you're good.
That would take away the shame.
Yeah. But you know, that's hard. I mean, that can be sometimes hard in specific ways. And for me, I'm still working at being able with certain people,
being able to claim
when I sense judgment from the other person. If I don't sense the judgment, you know, obviously I'm able to talk about it and feel good. And it's much better now. And I feel, honestly, even just talking about it right now, I feel much less shame around it than I have before. And I just, because like, what's the frickin' point? I mean, like, that is what the story is. And like, you know, that, and I haven't been ready for it until now. And like, that's just what the fucking, that's the deal. I want an anxiety that I have is like, you know, that will still arise all the time. It's like, is there something about me that's just flawed on the inside that just precludes this from happening, that I'll never be able to trick somebody into being in a relationship with me? But like, I'm getting, the only way through that is, I guess, just by continuing to just sort of like do what I'm instinctually wanting to do, which is to seek that intimacy out, and to, through that process, hopefully like realize there's all kinds of things, just like with my pilot, that are true, that my capacity to do things, including be in the relationship that I want to be in, are far greater than I might understand at this time.
And that also, just like the pilot, it's going to bring a lot of really great growth, but it's also going to bring a lot of messy growth.
For sure.
And it's just going to be all...
That's the other thing. I think I'm ready for the messiness. I think before there was a part of me that like couldn't handle the messy parts of it. Like that love often comes with pain, and like, you know, that I was like, why would I invite pain? That's crazy. I would never do that. Like, that's,
just stay home and cook.
Yeah. Like that's like less painful.
What is your biggest fear? What are you most afraid of?
I think I still, what it comes down, what I would have, for most of my life, I would have said, and like, this is somewhat still true, that I am afraid that I will, I'm afraid, I would have phrased it before as, I'm afraid that I won't fulfill myself as an artist, or that I won't fulfill my potential as an artist.
That you'll let yourself down.
Let myself down. And I think I still struggle with a fear. I think, and this sort of comes back to, I think,
hiding.
Mike's hiding and queerness, and also the way, like, not like my mind operating on all of these different levels, like of consciousness, like the subconscious part of myself that knew I was gay, but the conscious part of myself that was able to sort of look away from that. I think that I still have a fear that I'm going to do that I can just sort of, without, with the best intentions in my consciousness, that I will somehow find a secret way to sabotage myself, and that I can't trust myself, that I can't trust that my I can't trust my own awareness and consciousness. That's like a big fear I have that my reality is skewed,
that you'll let denial overpower
without being aware, even with, you know, like all of the knowledge that I've accrued and like everything that I know to be true about myself and about the world and every, you know. But as I said, it's like the experience of making this pilot and seeing how great that, how much it has to do with those two opposing forces. It's like, I've proven to myself in a major way that like the force that doesn't do that is really strong and stronger than the force that does do that. And so that gives me that alleviates, you know, when I can zoom out and look at that, that alleviates that. But that's like a huge overarching fear. And I think now that I've opened up this part of myself, the other fear is that I won't experience love.
There's a high stakes right now.
Yeah. I definitely, desperately want to fall in love and be fallen in love with simultaneously for once.
And I desperately want that for you.
Yeah.
What would you say is your definition of self-acceptance?
Right now, at least, this is all subject to change, but I think it's the absence of self-loathing because, I talk about this a lot. Like, it's like, I love people who just own their lives in this radical way. And it doesn't matter who they are, what the fuck they're doing, as long as they are just like loving it and owning it. Like, and that includes like being a fucking lazy asshole or like, you know, whatever it is, like
just real, true,
just owning it. And it's like not from a running place. Like it's from like a, this is my bliss and I'm owning it, or, you know, whatever it is, like I'm 100 pounds overweight. I'm whatever the thing is. It's just like that whenever someone stands behind themselves and like you can, and I feel that it's a thing you can sense when someone's doing it and they're running or they're doing it and it's coming from like a self-possessed place. Mm. But I feel that I don't give myself that. I'm reticent sometimes, and I still struggle with granting myself the same permission to own those things about myself, like the part of myself that is lazy. Like I have a lazy part of myself, and it creates a lot of great things that like we've talked about here. It has allowed these amazing like interests of mine to grow, and self-containment and
interests. I might add, for people that don't know, like you're a cook, staying home and cooking every night.
Cooking, which is history, amazing. Politics, you're an amazing cook.
Your entire DJ career wouldn't have happened.
Everything,
if you weren't
everything
to music. All
everything
day.
About me. I mean, I get so much joy out of my laziness. So, but not when there's this undercurrent of self-loathing underneath it. So for me right now, and this might be like a myopic version of it, but right now what I think is standing between me and self-acceptance is a latent self-loathing that I'm afraid to let go of. Because I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's like self-loathing, I think we're addicted, like it's like anxiety. You think it's an engine. You think you can like hate yourself into changing yourself. And in reality, like the more you just sort of dive into it, like your laziness or whatever, like that's the thing that just comes up for me a lot, because I can sort of be in these two extremes where I either am like the hardest working person who like gets more done than anybody could possibly imagine in a short spurt of time. And then I can like become like so slothful and like just, you know, inert.
Can barely buy a tube of toothpaste.
Yeah, exactly. I can't even like, can barely like answer an email. I can go from like, you know, being the boss of 75 people and juggling 5,000 things at once to like literally being unable to answer an email. And that's, you know, that's another, there's other parts of that that's like anxiety and whatever. But I think it's just like, actually the way to find the balance between the two things is to remove the self-loathing. Because I think like, then it's like the actual, you think, I think I'm going to self-loathe myself out of being lazy or whatever, but really it just makes me more inert, more unhappy. It prolongs unhappiness, you know, as opposed to just like just falling into that and then like creating space around it and then having more of a holistic and easy way to sort of like view like the seasons of life that are just part of my rhythm. And that's like when people are in touch with those things radically and just sort of like having a delighted interaction with their life as opposed to a hateful interaction with their life. That's self-acceptance.
What would you say to your 9 or 10 year old self? And then kind of, I don't know, is it the same? Would you trade it? Would you trade your experiences?
The person who I feel I'm becoming and the person who I aspire to become doesn't want to change anything.
So what would you say to your 9 year old self?
To all of my younger selves, I think I would just sort of be like, relax. relax. Like, everything is going to work out. Like, stop. I guess there were so many things I look back on and I'm like, this was such a big deal and that was such a big deal and and I was clenching and just sort of like, you know, I think the more you can sort of like be delighted by what's happening, even when it seems dark, I think that's like really like the best advice that I could give to myself over time would have been to just you don't have control. You can do everything that you can do, but you don't ultimately like have this much control, including on how people think about you and who you are and like what you look like and what, how people experience your selfhood and sexuality and just enjoy the awkwardness, enjoy the weirdness, enjoy like figuring out who you are, enjoy like instead of like thinking of it as this horrible, like fraught journey to some sort of destination that doesn't exist. Like it's just enjoy all of the weird, horrible, great things about life and the journey of it.
That's awesome. This was really amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Loon.
You're welcome, really, guys. Really. I feel like inspired for today more than I did a couple hours ago.
Me too, so. Kind of.
What do you feel inspired to do, Mom, differently? What are you taking
just
away?
What he was, Lewis was saying just now is like everything, just, you know, all of the, you know, to just take all of the tough and rough moments and try to treat them like with joy.
We hope you were inspired by this episode.
Until next week, that's it from me, Elisa.
And me, Lily.
If you agree that facades separate us and being radically honest brings us together, help spread the movement for radical self-acceptance by sharing this episode and subscribing to our podcast.
You can also watch our videos by subscribing to our YouTube channel and following us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @StyleIQ.
That's the letter U instead of the word U.
And check out our book, True Style is What's Underneath, The Self-Acceptance Revolution, on Amazon or at a local bookstore near you.
We can't skip ahead to a happy ending or live inside a Photoshopped image or an Instagram filter. There's no finding oneself when glossing over the truth.